Hello and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives, where we are at the ACE annual meeting in Las Vegas. My name is Diana Isaacs. I am joined with my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we have a very special guest with us today. We have Dr. Elizabeth Bauer, and she and I are both actually this year on ACE's board of directors, and she's the chair of ACE's Disease State Network. So we're so excited to have you here. And if you don't mind just introducing yourself and your role in practice a little bit for our listeners and viewers.
Yeah, and thanks so much for having me on. My name's Elizabeth, I go by Lisa. I'm a clinical endocrinologist and obesity specialist, mostly practicing in the diabetes and obesity realm right now clinically. I also do a little bit of research. I'm subspecialty coordinator for all the endocrine rotations through the clinic, and also in charge, I'm service chief for my clinic, which is an endocrinology and rheumatology clinic combined.
Oh, so interesting.
Stay busy.
Yes.
Mom awesome. With three yep. kids.
And, awesome. Well, we're so happy to have you here. Yes. And I know one of the talks that you gave here was the year in review for nutrition and obesity. And those are my favorite talks because it really like hits on the high points. Like, what were the key critical studies over the last year? So if we could just talk a little bit about that, if you can give us an overview of your talk.
Yeah. So I'll tell you, it was 60 minutes long. So this is going to be a quick one.
Right. Yes.
Really? So when I talk about it, it's going to be very condensed. Towards the last 15 minutes, I could see people starting to not fall asleep, but you're like, oh, it's been a while. There's just so much. And that's because in the last year, there has just been so much going on.
Yep.
And so I started the lecture actually going over the ACE, American Association of Clinical Endocrinology, algorithm for obesity that came out in November of last year.
Yes.
And it was really a kind of renewal of their 2016 CPG. And then in 2016, they did a position statement, and that is what coined the term adiposity-based chronic disease for obesity. And the algorithm is a disease-centric approach to the evaluation and treatment of obesity, just using these beautiful algorithms. And so there's 11 different algorithms on there, and each algorithm is a different facet of obesity evaluation and treatment, you know? And so it starts with like the 9 goals of care that they recommend. And then each algorithm's like, you know, how do you diagnose it? You know, there's screening and then anthropometric measurement that's needed. We need to know where the adiposity is, how much adiposity it is to actually say that it's obesity. Because if not, we're just saying that it's weight. Like, we can't just use BMI anymore. And then they'll have an algorithm on how do you do the anthropometrics and what are the cutoffs? Like, what can you use in clinic? What are the cutoffs for that? And then it walks you through on the different screening for, you know, diseases to put them into a stage. And in ACE, they use the 3 stages. So stage 1 is what, if you were trying to compare it to, say, Lancet Commission, it would be the preclinical obesity, where they don't have any noticeable or lab values that are abnormal, but they have excess adiposity. And then stage 2 is that they have excess adiposity and they have like mild impairments and diseases. And then stage 3 is end organ complications related to the obesity. Hmm. And it gives recommendations on how you would screen, like what lab tests you would do, physical exam. And then the last 2 in the algorithm are just these beautiful tables. And the first table is in a disease-centric approach. So in the first column, it's a lot of the very common complications of obesity, obstructive sleep apnea, you know, fatty liver diseases, and then all the obesity medications, and then the efficacy in them, right? And so it's just like one table where you see it all lined out. And then the last one is the obesity medications, and then everything you need to know about the medication. What are the doses? You know, what is it indicated in? What are the contraindications? What are the adverse effects? What are some tidbits on like the population you should use it in and stuff like that? And so just very clinically relevant for obesity and for clinical care. And it's so nice because with the residents, when they come through my clinic, I have a packet for them that they get. And inside of it will have certain things and different disease processes that they struggle with a little bit. And so I have some waiting for them. And one of them will be a chart of the obesity medication table, because then you don't have to remember everything. You can just glance down. And over time, you'll remember it, but at least now you know. So that was one part of my 60-minute conversation.
Yeah, and I think right. like that, yeah.
All
I
mean, by itself, right, and yeah.
I love that new, like, the new algorithm. I think it is so, like you said, the list of the medications and a quick resource to go to. And then I think just this idea of getting away from BMI. Like, for so long, we just classified obesity with BMI, and we know that's just...
It's not effective. It's not, we're missing people, we're diagnosing people who shouldn't be diagnosed. It goes in both directions. And it's all wrong. Is ending up what it happens. Where is their obesity? What's happening? What are the measurements? I think it's though, part of it, the challenge is in clinical practice, people have to change getting them on the scale, a person on the scale and saying, how tall are you? And then calculating a BMI, and now it's in the chart. For their height, their weight, forever, and that's it. And they're not looking at the rest of the person in front of them. Mm-hmm. So this really helps you do that, because we have to treat obesity both in endocrinology and in primary care. Because just like you in an obesity, what's your wait list? And for we're all doing that. I think we have to make it as simple as we can to get primary care to say, I'm going to add this to my list of things to do.
Exactly. And just to have a resource like that. And so if I didn't already love ACE, this probably would have been the thing. Actually, it was one of the things, because they did have similar charts for the 2016 one. And this one's just even better. But they just make these very helpful resources. Yes. And so it's like, I hear what you're saying, that you never received training in medical school, because... We didn't receive training in medical school.
Yep.
We had a pathophys lecture on adipose tissue. And then my pharmacy one talked about the medications, but as a drug, but not a combination of a disease and how to treat it.
Right.
And then the next thing I'll say is, I understand, I hear you, but here is this resource.
Right, that you can do this.
And
And we should be doing it, right?
Yes.
Yep.
And just like it changed in diabetes, you know, with the American Diabetes Association, where it was all very algorithmic, but in the sense where it was still always start with metformin, to now changing to more a disease-centric, or I guess complication-centric approach, where if you have this complication, maybe consider starting with a different type of medicine. This algorithm also is the first one to actually do that. And so when you're doing treatment selection, what complications do they have? Choose the medicine that's also going to treat the complication, and then choose the treatment goal based on that complication.
Wow.
And so if you have diabetes, 5% total body weight loss, you'll have great glycemic effects. But to see improvement in MASH, you need at least 10%, right? And the two can't be, they're not created equal. And so it helps us just, again, treat the patient, like you said. And the goal is whole health. It is not just weight, right? Because if not, you're going to be an unhealthy type of weight, and it's not going to be a better place.
Right. Yeah. That's a big part of it.
Yeah, that's huge. All right, what else? What other big things were in your talk?
So then I had three different sections, and one was on the pharmacotherapy, and then the second was surgical, and then the third was nutrition. And pharmacotherapy, I spent the majority of the time
because it's new, right? There's so many choices now, which is so wonderful.
Right,
absolutely.
And then I was waiting for somebody to get up and be like, why didn't you talk about this one? And it was like, do you know how many came out?
I could have done
it in the last. And so I talked about, a lot of the phase 3 trials that have come out of the new drugs. And so there was one that was performed in China, and using different BMI cutoffs and different inclusion cutoffs, you know, because it was in individuals who were Chinese. And so I like to see that because, again, we are not all created equal.
Right.
We have different genetics. We have different body composition. And so at a lower BMI, which is obesity for Asian, but different inclusions. And that was mazdutide. And that was a once weekly GLP. And so we talked about that one. That one has six other trials ongoing right now for that medication,
right?
Which it sounds like it's approved in China. It's not approved in the U.S. yet, but they're doing it versus semaglutide. They're doing a diabetes one. They're, you know, and so more to come.
Absolutely, right? Yeah.
And then, you know, talked about some combination ones that are coming out, like semaglutide and cagrilintide.
Yeah, that's exciting.
CagriSema, yep.
Yeah. Yep. And how, you know, the medication together had much more efficacy than semaglutide by itself. But I think they did it a really good way because they showed it. It was four arms, right? So you have the combination one, you have a Sema individual arm, you have a Cagra individual arm, and then you have a placebo.
Right.
And so you can say, you know, this is superior to these because of the efficacy.
Here's the data. Right.
You can also see that the nausea and the side effects are a lot higher too. And I think somewhere only like maybe, don't quote me, I need to pull my slides, but I think it was like 57% actually got to the dose, the max dose, because of the side effects, right? So it's high efficacy, even at lower doses, but also you're paying for, you know, the side effects. And so they're doing ongoing trials on, you know, how do we need to start lower, go longer, and what we need to do with that too. But that one's an interesting one. And so it was a phase two trial, and they actually had an obesity cohort, and then they had another one that was obesity plus diabetes. And so in the phase two, it actually was both of them, but showing very high efficacy in this medication, but also very, very high nausea,
right?
At these high doses that they started out in going forward.
Right. You know, people go online now and they're like, can I have some Zofran? I would like some. And they think that it's candy, right? That they can take it forever, every day. And there are side effects that we are concerned about with that. So how do you counsel people on that? How do you actually say, no, we don't do this forever? Sometimes you get nausea with dose titration, but sometimes people just have nausea from these medications. Do you recommend, you know, we do the dietary stuff, you know, lower fat, smaller meals, spread them out. But when they're asking for medications to treat and the nausea doesn't go away, do you hold back? Do you give a little bit of it? Do you have concerns about any of that?
And this is a great question.
Yeah.
And I will tell you that there is definitely no trials.
None.
On what is the right answer for this.
Yeah.
I also don't find it really helpful when you stop there and say there's no trials, because we're all doing this clinically, right?
Right.
And so as an obesity specialist and a diabetes specialist who uses these meds all the time, I run into this all the time.
Right.
And so a joke that I said yesterday was you can line up five endocrinologists and you can ask them the same question and you'll get five different answers. And then my co is moderating, Jamie Almondes. He was like, actually, if you ask the five endocrinologists, you'll get 10 different answers.
We could do this or this, right?
Could do exactly. This all day
right. Long. Which is beautiful. He's right. Exactly. Right.
So I'll tell you what I do. And I do this. I try to treat obesity and diabetes, but especially obesity, because of the stigma and bias associated with it in every facet of living with the disease and then treatment around the disease. I try to make sure that I'm treating it like I would treat the rest of the stuff, right? And so if I'm giving you a medication that is causing you to have a side effect, and then you're treating the side effect with another medication that may have another side effect, we are practicing medicine wrong.
Right.
And we're very good at switching in other disease processes, right? If in high blood pressure, if they are losing potassium,
we switch their pills.
You
switch.
You don't usually say, oh, here's a potassium pill, unless you had to use that diuretic or that thiazide for a reason.
Right.
You usually switch to something else, or you change the mechanism, maybe give them combination. And so we're already doing this with other disease processes.
Right.
And so let's treat it the same way. And so when I talk to providers with this answer, guess what I say to my patients? The exact same thing.
Right.
Because I'm saying that I'll answer your question, but I'm first going to explain to you, you know, you're going to understand my answer after I explain this, but I'm going to set the stage, you know, because I think if you just say yes or no, they don't hear the rest. So I first say this and I give an intro, you know, like that. You don't treat a side effect with another medication, you know, and then that one has another one. So with titration of the medications, I will give them some, but I give them somewhere like 5 tabs.
Right.
And it may be the 8 milligrams that I'm telling them to cut in half, okay, but it's a very limited amount. And I'm saying if we are having to renew these meds, the Zofran, or if you're using Compazine or whatever, the Phenergan, I usually will use Ondansetron.
Yep.
And so to answer your question, I will give them some Zofran, but it is a small amount. And it's very clear that if this continues, I need to change your medicine.
Right.
Because I am causing you harm and I did not become a doctor to cause you harm.
I love that answer.
I end it with that every single time.
I love that.
That's how I feel.
Yeah. And I think also in clinical trials, you know, they have to kind of progress to whatever target dose they're trying to get to. In real practice, like, we can go slower as needed.
Correct.
So they can keep someone on a lower dose for longer so they tolerate it. And just going back even to the MariTide, the monthly, which I think is exciting to have a monthly GLP-1, because it's phase 2, right, they're still trying to figure out the dosing. So hopefully, as we may see phase 3 trials, they figure out some of the dosing that could reduce some of these GI side effects.
Yeah, and in that same trial, they did a smaller study. It was like 43 days long, and it was the pharmacokinetic study, but they started at a much lower dose, and there were 3 dosing structures in that one.
Right.
And I think the max dose was maybe 35 milligrams in that one, and the nausea was much, much, much less. There was no discontinuation by the 43 days, and then there was, it was something like 2% nausea in the first 2 weeks.
Wow.
Now, it was much more over the 43 days, but it was a very big difference than starting at the higher doses.
Right.
And so, you're right.
They may be able to solve this on a different.
Right, absolutely. Right. I don't think we're going to eliminate GI side effects, but we'll be able to put it more at the level that we see in other clinical trials. Right. And the other thing with these clinical trials, and the appendix of the MariTide actually has it, and I need to review it more, is they usually don't tell you when. Right? They don't tell you, did it happen day 1, 2, 3? Right. Did it happen the second injection? Like, when is all the nausea? Yeah. Is this just one event that happened?
Because once they report it, they're part of the nausea reporting matter what.
Right. Was it 87% because they had it once?
Right.
And they're very, you know, they're seeing the efficacy and they're not having any side effects, but that one time made that 1%.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so I think we need more details of that. But clinically, we see this. I just don't see the numbers that are in the clinical trials or people
in
being,
your regular practice.
No,
I don't either.
Not
I don't
at all.
No, yeah. No. Mm-hmm. I think when we prepare someone for the side effect profiles, you may have this, you may not. Right? This is what we're going to do ahead of time. This is how, and give people an opportunity to reduce that risk. I think it helps a whole lot when we're having those conversations.
Yeah. So going back to your talk, I recall you saying bariatric and nutrition also studies. So any highlights there with those two areas?
Yeah. So there were two bariatric surgery studies that I reviewed that were, one was a 3-year trial and it was pretty much comparing lap band, sleeve, and to ruin why.
Okay.
And it was actually a superiority trial and it was able to show superiority in the sleeve over the band and ruin why over the band. And then, but not so much against ruin why and sleeve to each other. But for the sleeve, or sorry, for the band, more side effects, statistically significant. Each of them had, there was death, but not related to the surgery, but the lap band one did have one death that was surgical related. And so it was like higher side effects, you know, higher complication rates and less efficacy for sure in the lap band compared to the sleeve and the ruin.
Interesting.
Why. Okay. And then the other one was actually a 10-year follow-up from a 3-year study that was published, you know, 10 years ago or something, the SM Boss study. And it was a 10-year follow-up of sleeve gastrectomy versus ruin Y gastric bypass. Also looking at, you know, weight loss effects. And they use these metrics that are like, you know, BMI, excess BMI, you know, so it's like excess weight loss instead of just weight loss. And then now it's like excess BMI loss. And so it's all these things, but their secondary endpoint will be just weight loss. And so that's the one you're like, okay, now I can compare this to other things. But the interesting thing part about both of those reviews, or and they're both RCTs, randomized controlled trials, is that Ruin Y was better from a number standpoint, but it didn't meet statistical significance for, you know, weight loss at the 10-year mark.
Isn't that amazing?
And and it was the same thing in their 3-year trial, but there's been other ones that definitely show a difference. And then the one that I didn't review, but is in my appendix area, like after the thank you, I have like 15 more slides or something.
Of course you do.
Because they were just so interesting.
Right.
But it was a systemic review of all these bariatric surgery trials, you know, outlining in those numbers are very different than the RCT that I showed. And so take it with a grain of salt. But it is interesting that, you know, they're both high efficacy for weight loss, both of them together. For side effects, from the sleeve, only 7% of the Ruin Y needed a conversion or reoperation therapy, but was it 30%? Some high amount needed it going from sleeve to Ruin Y.
Wow.
So they had to get a reoperation. And the reason why the numbers aren't sticking is because in that paper, they have two different tables, two different numbers. And so one will be 29.5, if I remember correctly, for the conversion. And that one, I can do the math. I can do the amount that needed numerator, denominator. And then they have a Kaplan-Meier curve that is like 73% or some crazy amount.
Right.
And I'm like reading everywhere and I put it up there because I like to just show, you know, like, I didn't do this trial.
Right.
I tried.
Yeah.
One of these numbers is right. I'm pretty sure it's this one because I can do the math to back it up. But a very large amount needed a conversion because they didn't lose sufficient amount of weight or they had a significant amount of reflux.
Wow.
Okay. So that's something that providers need to know.
So I do want to ask you one question about bariatric surgery in general. We're seeing more and more people put back on GLP-1s. And GLP-GIPs after surgery. Can you talk a little bit about that? And we're seeing more success with it. But as a nurse practitioner, I just want to know how you feel about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a well-known fact that, you know, it's called weight recidivism, but we're actually trying to eliminate that term because that's a prison term.
Yes, absolutely.
You do a crime,
right.
You go to jail.
Uh-huh.
And so, but the weight regain that happens afterwards. And, you know, there's been a lot of research on why does this happen. And it's like 10 different theories on it. And it's a combination of a little bit of physiology, a lot of bit of environment. And, you know, the same, the issue is that, again, obesity is a disease.
Yes, it is.
Right?
Right.
And so we're treating a disease with a surgery, which is making an anatomical change, right? And the sleeve is very different from Ruin Y. One is malabsorptive and one is not.
Right.
And so there's hormonal changes that are different on both sides, yet we're categorizing them as like surgical. But the big success is that you have a smaller stomach and you can't fit as much food in. And so it's making a behavioral change as a result of it. And then if you add on the malabsorption stuff, then that too. And so, but it's still a disease. And so if you don't lose the dysfunctional adipose tissue, you still have the inflammation, you still have the signaling changes, and it's still, you're still fighting against biology. So if your brain is telling you thoughts of food all day and making you hungry, feel hungry all the time. And someone the other day was like, oh, but they're not supposed to have hunger signals. You cut out the part that has ghrelin. I was like,
no, I didn't.
This is going to take too long.
Exactly.
Right. To go
this is not right.
You know, so there's all this misinformation that is out there too on, you know, we fixed the issue. And it's like, did we? You know, it's a disease process. And so there has been weight regain and there will continue to be weight regain. But with the GLPs now, you actually have some data showing if you start someone on GLPs before surgery, they not only lose more weight, but the weight regain is less, right? And so there's some data coming out on that kind of stuff, or starting it pretty early right after surgery, or when they start to regain weight. And so there's many different areas to do it in, but you can't fight a disease with, stop pretending it's a cure.
Right.
It's the same thing with diabetes. Are we ever truly cured from diabetes?
Right.
You know, it was dysfunctional tissue and we didn't get rid of it all.
Right.
And so it doesn't, and you still have the same genes. And so it can still be activated. It can still like switch over. But
I love that idea.
Yeah. Right. Well, this has been an amazing discussion.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us. We thank you all for tuning in. That wraps up this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives from ACE.